My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Farn and Frank Muir challenge Anscott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which tests their vocabulary. For 2 marks, what's the meaning of the following words? And the first one for Frank Muir is cabalistic.
One meaning of it, Jack, is it's a ballistic problem of how high and at what tangent you shoot your arm when trying to stop a cab. But beyond that, cabalistic is esoteric,
yeah,
with occult,
yeah,
undertones, mm-hmm, or conspiratorial undertones.
Yes, that's good enough for the 2 marks. It relates to the secret, traditional, but magical knowledge in interpreting their scriptures by the Jewish rabbis, and then it became used as generally meaning the occult. 2 marks. Anscott James, yours is a quincunx. It's very hard to pronounce. Quincunx, quincunx.
Well, I know what it is, but I don't know how it gets there. What it is a formal arrangement of trees.
Yes.
There's a famous quincunx at Hidcote, which is, I suppose, one of the most famous ones,
yes,
in England, of pleached hornbeams, and I think, if I remember right, there are 10 of them.
Yes.
But which is multiples of 5, isn't it?
Multiples of 5 is all right. 5 objects so placed that 4 occupy the corners, either of a square or a rectangle, and the 5th one is at the center. The easiest example is a 5 of cards, whichever pack it is. And it then comes to be applied to the arrangement of large numbers of trees on this essential basic pattern. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, a bandobast. It's spelt B-A-N-D-O-B-A-S-T, but as far as my knowledge of Hindi stretches, it's pronounced bandobast.
Oh, is it? But it's spelt bandobast.
That's right, absolutely right.
It sounds like one of those sticky dressings you have applied.
What kind of
Banda.
Monkey, would you think?
Monkey? It's a man
animal.
Bandobast is a bra, surely.
It's a bandobast. It's not quite so helpful as that.
No, it isn't. It really isn't.
It's a bandobast.
Hindu word, we think.
It is, in fact, the arrangements your secretary, Dennis, no doubt is making for you safely to go to Portugal and back again in the near future. In other words, it's the organization of the details of a journey, a military campaign, a sit-down strike, or even a tea party. And it is comes from a Hindustani word, meaning originally tying and binding. That is, you had to put the loads up onto the pack animals before you could move off safely. That's what it is.
I think that's an excellent description of a package holiday, though. It's both a military campaign, a sit-down strike,
everything.
All of that. No, I must get onto a travel agent. Have you got my bandobast for...
And back for... Dennis Bowe, ferriage.
That's an organisation for transporting the bandobast, I should think.
On what?
On a ferry.
That's a shrewd thought.
2 marks at once. It's the action or business of ferrying passengers or goods from point A to point B. It also can be the amount your charge for getting from point A to point B, but the point is that it is on water.
Across the Styx.
A stock across the Styx. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. And before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations you were given for the last round of all, and Frank Muir, yours is all my possessions for a moment of time, and yours, Dennis Norden, never underestimate the power of a woman. Well, the next round is a round of assorted aphorisms, and for 2 marks, can you suggest or tell me which literary personage it was who gave voice to the following fairly profound thoughts? We begin again with Frank Muir. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds.
It, yes, I think I know. It's 19th century.
Yes.
And I think it's Brillat Savarin.
No, cross
it was the philosopher of cookery.
Yes, he was.
And it's this thing of the consistency of a mayonnaise is so terribly important. And what he's saying is it isn't all that important. It's whatever it is.
Well, it curdles, it doesn't matter.
That's right. He lived at a time which is appropriately called Belly or Belay. But would you cross the Atlantic?
I've forgotten the quotation.
A foolish consistency is a hobgoblin of little minds. And think of those great sages in the United States.
It's an American.
States, yes.
Sage. Thoreau.
No, he lived in the woods.
Of Concord, Mass. Emerson.
Emerson.
Ralph Waldo.
Well done. Well done. Emerson's essays, this is called Essay on Self-Reliance, and it's echoed later on by Whitman. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes.
Actually, the idea behind it is really quite 18th century. Samuel Johnson did the same thing, that you must change your views as you get older.
Okay.
There's no merit in not changing your mind as you change your age.
I think he creeps home to his 2 marks. And Anne Scott James, it's your turn next. Anger makes dull men witty, but it keeps them poor.
It's a very controvertible remark, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. But I think dull men might help you as to date.
But, I mean, most people now regard controversy as an absolute sure path to a whacking income, don't
they? Absolutely, yeah.
Cash in on your violence.
Yes.
Especially in journalism.
Go back to QE1.
Ah, yes, well, we now think this is Elizabethan, do we not?
Yes.
Anger makes dull men with you. I can't believe it's Shakespeare, said anything so boring.
Well, some people thought he was Shakespeare.
Oh,
fantastic. Well, a lot of people were thought to be Shakespeare, but let us try Francis Bacon, shall we?
That's a very, a very good shot. Francis Bacon's apothegms, and it was supposed to be a remark he made to Queen Elizabeth I herself.
A very unwise thing to have done.
He lost it very well. Dennis Norton, mankind is divisible into 2 great classes, hosts and guests.
Oh, I know this.
Do you say it then? Go on.
I think it's Max Beerbohm.
No, quite right.
<Well done. coughs>
I only know this because we always have such arguments at home, and I thump the table and say, you're a terrible host, my husband, but you are the most marvellous guest. He says, all right, you look after the wine and drink and all the rest of it, and I will
Robert Benchley said that the world is divided into 2 types of people. The type of person who divides the world into 2 types of people and the type of person who doesn't.
Very, very intelligent.
I'd like to give an extra mark for that, but it isn't
brilliant.
Actually what
Free
I
grass.
Asked. You've got 2 Max Beerbohm hosts and guests, and it's parallel with the other great saying that after 3 days, fish and guests begin to stink.
Everybody here on their way home should start deciding which they are, hosts or natural guests.
Yeah. Now, Dillisbow, to end this round, the man who is always talking about being a gentleman never is one. Intolerable remark.
Chesterfield.
Contemporary.
Contemporary.
Fox hunting and things like that. And
Fox hunting. That's is that wild?
No, he only tangentially approached fox hunting.
Is it 30s?
Yes, that's right.
Right.
2 marks. It's R.S. Surtees, the inventor of Jorrocks, among other things, in something called Ask Mama, written in 1858.
Surtees, who said something which I felt very keenly when I used to try to ride a horse. He said, if you don't behave, I shall take you home and boil you.
To the horse. Yes, that's right. We now come to a round of origins and derivations, and 2 marks again. How did the following words or phrases originate, or from what did they eventually derive? And Frank Muir, yours is appropriately a lumber room.
Lumber means timber.
Among other things.
Yes. It also means offcuts of timber.
Yes.
It also meant waste timber. So it was it also meant a pawnbroker.
That's what I wanted.
You lumbered. You put something in lumber when you pawned it. I'm going back a bit.
You are going to have to go back a bit to this.
Yes. So a lumber room was where you parked stuff which you didn't particularly need at the moment.
Or
it was useless.
Or you had pawned.
Or pawned, yeah.
And who were the original pawnbrokers?
Well, they were the Italian city banker barons, weren't they?
Yeah, but it's almost the same word, Frank. It's quite easy if you translate lumber into...
Lombard.
That's what I wanted. Forget that. 2 marks to Frank. The Lombards were the great pawnbrokers in medieval times, and their places of business were known as Lombard shops. And if you had a room at the top where people who pawned their stuff... what they got was kept until they could redeem it. That would be a lumber room in a Lombard shop. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, this is a very difficult one. Sycophant, 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 how did it originate?
Well, this is child's play to me.
Oh, hooray.
Well, Sucos, I'm just going to be thoroughly pedantic now. It's Greek for a fig.
Yes.
And phino means to show.
Absolutely right.
And when travellers used to arrive in Athens and other Greek cities, sort of creepy crawlies used to come up and say, I will show you the figs, I will show you the figs, where you can sit in the shade or pick the figs or whatever. Hence, the word sycophant, which really means...
fig shower.
A creepy crawly or a sucker upper. Would that do?
Full marks that one.
I was thinking, absolutely.
Yes. And nowadays, if you ever use the word, which I don't often myself, it means a sponger or a toady. Now, Dennis Norton, to be, Dennis, in a scrape.
Well, applying the same intelligent logic or a vestige of it that Anne displayed, it means to be in trouble, to encounter aggro, to in some ways scrape, as in when you scrape your knees as a child and you had to apply a bandabast, your mum put it on. So to be in a situation where you can scrape yourself and draw blood and have abrasions of the skin.
I think rather than abrasion, if you would think of a hole in the ground, it might help you.
I don't know an abrasion from a hole in the ground. Why would I think of a hole in the ground?
Well, it's a hole scraped by wild deer, which they do apparently. Sometimes it gets a foot or more deep, and if you were riding a nice horse through the glade or a forest, your horse might stumble and throw you, and you would then be in that particular deer's scrape. Dillis, yours is sounds simpler. An idiot. Derivation.
Idiot.
Idiot.
I-D-O-T.
That's right.
Now, that is Greek again.
Yes.
Athenian, I think. I mean, idiot, idiotist was a private citizen, I think.
Yes.
He was an idiot. He should join the government.
That's right.
Nowadays, an idiot is a self-employed citizen.
Well, it is. It
comes to the government.
All of that is absolutely right. It meant a private person not engaged in public office, and so they presumed, as people still presume, that he was without professional knowledge or an ignoramus. And hence it came to mean what it does today. Somebody so defective in mind from birth as to be unable to guard himself or herself against ordinary physical dangers. It's a word that's gone downhill very steadily. Too much.
And we all.
And now we come to the last round. And to Frank and Dennis's quotations, And the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Frank, your quotation was, "All my possessions for a moment of time," and I believe that was Queen Elizabeth I, shortly before she died.
Well, latterly, it was me to the vicar. Actually, the new vicar. It all began, I suppose you could say, a few days ago, when my wife was looking at a picture of Dominic Mintoff, and she said, "Look at his tummy, it's as flat as a board." "You see this picture?" And I said, "Well, flat tummy doesn't... If you show yours isn't as flat, look at that. Look at his tummy. It's absolutely straight up and down." Well, of course, I didn't worry about this. My wife accusing me of having a flabby tum, it didn't upset me at all. Now, about an hour later, I came out of the cupboard and got a dry hanky, and I was thinking about it. Whereas when I was very young, I was in silhouette, like an exclamation mark. There's now a touch of the question mark. You know, it's the terms of trying to go forward, which is it. So I thought, if I could correct my posture. So I got a BBC publication on yoga, and there was which is kind of exercise thing. So I tried the first one I tried was the sort of slimming exercise, was the lotus position, which is really quite fun. You sit down, and you sort of interweave your legs. And the final sort of lock is quite difficult, but if you pull it through, it goes in quite easily. Much easier than it comes out. I was upstairs at the time. I managed to bounce my way on my bottom down the stairs, which is rather painful. And I managed to crawl onto the tea trolley and sort of row myself out of the back door and into the garage. And then there was the car jack. I put longitudinally between my knees and just worked that. And I managed... I think the fault was having my gum boots on at the time. Then I thought I'd do it properly, so I got myself a set of gear like the lady on the cover of the yoga book. I've got a black T-shirt, which I found in my son's drawer, who has rather eccentric taste in these things. I had to wear it inside out, actually, because it's got a photograph of a chap on the front with a head like a fur-bearing cannonball, and he's got his nose apparently fixed to his face with a safety pin. And it's on these, "I am a punk rocker." But I put that on upside down, and I put black bathing trunks, which I happen to have, and a pair of my wife's black tights. If you haul on those, they sort of go upwards almost indefinitely. The crutch is a bit low, actually. Just above the knees, like the front legs of a rather elderly elephant. But I got into this stuff and decided to do the whole exercise, the whole eight positions recommended to the lady. She said, "Choose a proper time, you know, make it regular, sort of 7:30. I thought she meant 7:30 in the evening. You can't do exercise in the morning. You creak, don't you? You know? And your foot goes funny, you know, as you walk. So I did it at 7:30 in the evening. And the other mistake, probably in retrospect, was I'd forgotten that people were coming. But I got into my black set, and I did the lotus position, and then I suddenly heard a noise, and I opened my eyes, and the room was full of the Thorpe Village Fete committee headed by our new vicar. I don't know how long they'd been there. But they were staring at me. I was in the upside-down position with my toes hooked over the door. And eventually the vicar cleared his throat and said... he said, "Ballet positions?" So I said, no, ballet positions. And then with a note of pride, which I'm sure Queen Elizabeth I had in her voice when she said it, I said... "All my positions for a more Mintoff tum."
Live to see frank squatting like the Buddha that I haven't done yet, and we go on to Dennis Norden. If you remember, his quotation was, "Never underestimate the power of a woman."
It wasn't much of a kiss. So briefly did her lips touch mine, you could hardly even call it a kiss. In fact, I remember thinking, I've had more sensation from an electric toothbrush. But still, at the age of 17, to be kissing Fenella Ollerenshaw at all, well, it was like the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo, then going on to win the Irish sweepstakes. I went to draw her to me again, but she pulled herself free, and she said, "Don't let's waste any more time. Get your clothes off." And she left the bedroom. Well, as I removed my garments, I reviewed the strange course of our relationship. We'd met at the tennis club where I'd been drawn as her partner in the junior mixed doubles, and right away I'd spotted that she was from a world far above mine. "She's Alderman Ollerenshaw's daughter," whispered Lefty Perkins, who sat next to me in geometry, so she was a girl I trusted. Who hadn't heard of the Ollerenshaws? They were the aristocracy of the county. Their menfolk held the doors open for their wives, even when nobody was looking. Their womenfolk served two kinds of afters, even when there were no relations sitting down. The true gentry. And when we came off the court, I thought about it. Incidentally, we won six love, because Fenella was the only one in the game who could serve overarm. I said to her, will you be my girl? And she said, "Oh, don't be ludicrous." I said, "Well, why not?" She said, "Because I'm upper class and you and your family are rubbish." I said, "Well, only financially and physically." she tossed her head, that yellow hair with the glint of gold in it like the sun on cornflakes, and she said, "My father would never approve of you." I said, "Put me to the test, please, put me to the test. Let me meet him." So she narrowed her eyes and said, "All right, come to tea next Saturday." Well, as I walked home that night, my heart was leaping like a gazelle beneath the locknet of my vest. And as I burst open the front door, Dad, I shouted, "I'm in love with a girl." He said, "Son, you've made a wise choice." He said, "Who is she? Who is she?" I said, "Fenella Ollerenshaw. I'm meeting her father on Saturday, and if he approves of me, the world will be my gherkin." I mean, the kind of neighborhood I lived in, who knew about oysters, you see. Well, all this went through my mind as I was placing the last of my garments over the Chippendale wash basin in her bedroom. Oh, incidentally, the reason for all that was that on my arrival, Fenella had explained that, like so many upper-class families, the Ollerenshaws were naturists, and so they always took Saturday afternoon tea naked in the garden, something that the lesser orders like us were unable to do, of course, because quite apart from the fact none of us had a large enclosed back garden, we weren't accustomed either to balancing hot tea on our laps. Naked. And then from outside I heard Fenella's silvery voice summoning me with that little private pet name she'd bestowed on me, "Yobbo." She was crying, she was shouting, "Daddy's waiting." So gingerly and naked
as a shelled egg, I descended the stairs into the drawing room through the French windows and onto a lawn that looked as though it had been manicured with nail scissors. You have, of course, anticipated me. They were fully clothed. All of them. Her father, her mother, her four grandparents, the two visiting bishops. It's always difficult to offer advice to any young man meeting a young girl's father for the first time. But I think as a result of my experience, I can now contribute one fairly safe rule. Never undress to meet the power of a woman.
Cruel story. And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the story, and he and Anne Scott-James also win the contest for this week.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott-James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longman. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.